Welcome to the All of Christ for All of Life podcast, brought to you by Canon Plus. This week's episode is a conversation between Jared Longshore and Dr. Ben Merkel on Dr. Merkel's book, The White Horse King, The Life of Alfred the Great. Listen to the audiobook of The White Horse King now on Canon Plus.
Thank you for joining us for this video. I have the privilege of sitting with Dr. Ben Merkel, who is the president of New St. Andrews College. He is also a DPhil from Oxford. He is also not only was a Marine, but is a Marine even now. And he has also written a wonderful book called The White Horse King.
Yes.
King Alfred the Great.
Yeah, Life of King Alfred.
The Life of King Alfred the Great. I actually just finished it today. And nice. I read it, really enjoyed it, and thought it would be good for us to talk a little bit about it. So thank you for joining me.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So you went to Oxford, and in Oxfordshire, there's a statue of Alfred the Great. I imagine you probably have laid eyes on it.
Just south of Oxford in Wantage is this. There's one in Wantage, then if you go all the way south a little bit further to Winchester, there's another one in Winchester. Wantage is where he was born, so they have a statue there, and then Winchester is where his capital was and where he ruled from, so they have a statue there. So he rules, spends most of his life in Winchester. He's born in Wantage, but I like the Wantage one because he's standing there with this really cool battle axe. Like Winchester, he's got like a very noble, you know, two-handed sword, but in Wantage, he's just got his axe, which I thought is like, I just like that one.
Yes, and you have a quote in the book that is on that statue. And I wanted to read it to kick it off. So on that very statue is engraved these words, Alfred found learning dead and he restored it, education neglected and he revived it, the laws powerless and he gave them force, the church debased and he raised it, the land ravaged by a fearful enemy from which he delivered it. Alfred's name shall live as long as mankind shall respect the past. And I actually did a little research, and I found it interesting that that statue of Alfred was vandalized in 2007, 2008.
Yep. And we were there.
Oh, you were there for
this? Yeah, we were there, because it was like you're driving through one day, and the axe is gone. We were like, what happened to the axe? And I think it happened twice, because then somebody felt bad about it, and they actually gave the axe back, but then it disappeared a second time.
And hasn't returned?
No, I think they got something there now. So I think it's back together.
Gosh.
I'll have to go. I'm going to go this summer, so I'll check on the axe.
Alfred went through all that, like being raided by Vikings his whole life, and he's still being raided by.
Don't mess with Alfred, though. I just wouldn't do that.
Yes. So before we talk about the book, and before you give us a snapshot of Alfred's life, let's just talk about how'd you come to write this book?
Yeah. Okay. So I did a master's in English Lit at the University of Idaho. It initially started as just a weird little side thing, and then it kind of slowly sucked me in. Had just a really good prof who did medieval literature. And 1 year I found out he was going to offer a whole year where you would do, the first semester we would do a semester of Anglo-Saxon grammar, and the second semester we would read Beowulf in the Anglo-Saxon. So that was one of the coolest things. And what was fun was I actually got, Doug Wilson, my father-in-law, he always had like a hankering for Anglo-Saxon. I was like, do you want to take this class with me? So for that year, Doug and I took Anglo-Saxon together and then translated Beowulf together.
Can you give us like some Anglo-Saxon just off the cuff? You got a line or two?
What?
Okay. All right.
No. Father Ura through the earth on Helvnum, our father who art in heaven.
Nice.
Yeah. If you look at it, like it sounds gnarly at first, but when you look at it, it's actually like, okay. You recognize
these are my people. English. These are my people.
Yeah, you can find it. So as far as languages go, it's actually a rather easy one. But so I'd done some Anglo-Saxon, and then I had to write a thesis. At the time, I was teaching at NSA, and I was teaching Lordship, which you now have, and I was teaching the NSA's Hebrew course. So I was trying to figure out. No. Sorry, the Hebrew had nothing to do with it. That was later on. So I'm teaching Lordship, and I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to write a thesis on. And I wanted something is there anything that relates to anything I'm teaching at Lordship? And I saw in Lordship, we do Augustine's Confessions and also City of God. Augustine also, one of his earliest works after his conversion was his soliloquies. And I found out Alfred the Great had translated the soliloquies from Latin into Anglo-Saxon. And there were some partial translations, but no complete translation. So I proposed for my thesis to do a translation of Alfred's soliloquies from Anglo-Saxon into modern English and do like a commentary on it. And he, you know, he's pretty free with the text. So there's a lot of it like, this is not Augustine. This is just pure Alfred. Augustine's book was two books. Alfred's was three books. So there's one whole book that's just pure Alfred. So it made it kind of, it was a fun project. So I had that and I graduate with my MA. I'm accepted to go do graduate work in Oxford and I show up there. And it was right then that Aaron Wrench, who, if you're, he's one of these characters that in Moscow is kind of behind a lot of things, but you don't notice right off. But he's the guy that's like putting together everybody's book deals. And this was when he was first lining up all these interesting book deals. And somehow he got this deal with Thomas Nelson where he was trying to land people to write for Thomas Nelson. And so he reached out to me and said, do you have any biographies, you know, that you would like to do? And I was like, I can do Alfred. That's all I got, you know? And he landed like an amazing book deal for me to write a biography of King Alfred. And I get this deal where I'm living in Oxford and everything around me is Alfred, which is like an amazing opportunity. So over the next year, we're homeschooling our kids. So we're just taking them to all the Alfred sites. So I got to spend a whole year with the family cruising around, you know, visiting all these places and then slowly putting together the story of Alfred's life, which is what becomes that book.
Nice.
It was a ton of fun. It was a bit of a heavy lift doing that on the side of doing my Oxford studies and whatnot. But man, we had so much fun exploring the countryside and me diving deeper into Alfred's story. And Aaron did a great job. So it, you know, it paid for a year of Oxford for me, which was great.
Okay. So you've seen the terrain, you've seen the place, you kind of steeped in the man's life. Just give us in a nutshell, like the 10,000 foot view. Who was Alfred? Where did he live? What did he do? And then we can dive out with a parachute and do some more granular stuff. But what's the snapshot?
I mean, the thing about Alfred is if there wasn't an Alfred, there wouldn't be an England. And very rarely can you come down to like one person who is so pivotal. But like you really can get all the way down to like it. England exists because of Alfred. Because early on in the early Anglo-Saxon England, even to say that is anachronistic because there wasn't an England. You had the Isle of Britain, and then you had these little Anglo-Saxon kingdoms all over. But what happens is in the 9th century, like right at the end of the 8th century, and then into the 9th century. You have these Viking invasions that are coming over from the continent and initially just plundering and raiding, but then after a while, they are starting to just actually conquer. And it starts to the north and then it works its way all the way down. So each of these little individual Saxon kingdoms is picked off until there's only one Saxon kingdom left, and that's Wessex, which is in the southwest. So bottom left of the Isle of Britain, you have Wessex as the lonely kingdom that's left. And Alfred he shouldn't have been king. He's like the fifth son, you know, he shouldn't have been king, but all of his father and all of his brothers slowly die off till he actually inherits the crown. And he inherits the crown right at the moment when they're the last ones and the Vikings are invading and they drive them all the way. Well, they drive Alfred actually completely into hiding. But from that place, he puts together an army. He puts together this resistance that then goes to open battle, fights the Vikings, beats them, and then slowly pushes them back. But as he does so, and this is what makes that book so interesting, is like he's not just a military, leader. He understands what it means to put together a human culture and society in a God-honoring way. So he revitalizes every institution, and it all comes out of a deep evangelical Christian faith that he has. So he rebuilds the army. He rebuilds the infrastructure. He rebuilds the government. He establishes England's laws on a godly platform, begins the common law tradition. He revitalizes the church and he launches a literary renaissance that you don't see in any other period in the Anglo-Saxon England. The renaissance that happens under him is really significant. He slowly pushes the Vikings back. It's not until his grandson that you finally have the English king pushes the Vikings all the way out, And now England is all united under one king. And that's when it's under, that's why I say it's under Alfred, they become England. They become the English people. And it's all united under the crown that he, you know, he leads them under.
So Alfred's in Wessex. You mentioned that he went into hiding. Does he go into hide? He goes into hiding after Ashdown. Was Ashdown first?
Yes, he does.
Because Ashdown was his first, was that his first
That's
time
his
in
first
battle?
Battle.
All right. So why don't we start there? Like you mentioned where Wessex is. Yeah. So where is Ashdown? Lay out the scene for us and what happens at this
point. Yeah,
particular
there's debates
battle.
About where Ashdown actually is. So in my book, I argue for him being at the Vale of the White Horse, which is just south of Oxford. And you know, I think it's to me the most probable location. I could be wrong. In the resurrection, we'll find out where it really is. But that I would argue for that location, so just south of Oxford. So yeah, the Viking army comes. When at the Battle of Ashdown, I think we're in 871. I wrote this all in like 2007. So
you're gonna be like
I'm a little bit.
15 something years.
Yeah, I'm a little bit foggier, but I think it's around 871. You have the Battle of Ashdown. And at this point, his father has died. His older brothers have died, except for his the next up. So Alfred is not king. His older brother is king. Alfred is helping him. And they go to this battle. The Viking army has, you know, they've encountered this raiding army. And there's this funny description where Alfred and his brother, they're going to take two halves of the army and they agree, okay, you go that way, I'll go this way. We're going to meet him on the battlefield. Alfred goes out, he gets his men all lined up. They march onto the field. The Viking army lines up in the shield wall, begins approaching, and Alfred looks and his brother's not there. And his brother and his brother's whole army doesn't show up. So Alfred is hosed, but you can't turn and run. Like your safest thing is to form up and to engage. So he does. And then the account of the battle, it says something like basically his brother had been long in his prayer. So after the deal to go meet on the battlefield, his brother goes in to pray and apparently had a few more sins to confess. Like this may be the end. So he's really working through it. And is a little bit tardy to the battlefield. And but it ends up being a brilliant, you know, brilliant tactically, whether they planned it that way or not, because Alfred has completely engaged the Viking shield wall. And now his brother comes over the horizon from the side and they just wipe him out. So they're victorious at the Battle of Ashdown, but it's only a temporary victory. It's just a few months after that, his brother actually dies. We don't know what kills him. It may have been injuries from the battle, who knows? But his brother dies, Alfred is king, and the Vikings keep on coming. And that's when they push him into hiding in this little swampy area, a place called Athelney, where he's hiding out, like almost like a Robin Hood kind of scene.
Uh-huh. Is that Athelney also in Wessex?
Yes. It would be in the nation of Wessex, but it's much further south.
Further south. But this is, the Vikings are coming into Wessex territory.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
Wessex is the last holdout.
Right. And so at this point, they've really taken all of England because Alfred is in hiding and he was the last king.
Okay. And this Athelney, so like a swampland area? And he's
They describe it kind of marshy, but when you go there now, I mean, England doesn't do, it's like the moors, not marshy is wrong. It's the moors, which is this kind of wild land that he's hiding out in.
You know how long he's there?
It's really just, it's less than a year. It's kind of over the course of a winter.
And he's the king.
Well, he's the king, but he's hiding out.
Hiding out. And how does he get out of it?
Basically, he slowly, there are lots of legends about Alfred during this time, you know, stories of him, dressing up as a jester or entertainer and sneaking into the Viking camp and all this. The stories are from quite a bit later and are probably just mostly come from people's imagination about what this time was like. But basically, he slowly coordinates and regroups his men and gathers them together, and then they meet again on the battlefield. You know, he challenges the Vikings again to battle. I think the Vikings are surprised. They didn't realize he was able to gather all his men like that. And he calls them all to battle, and then he's victorious. and then slowly begins pushing them back out.
I think you mentioned this in the book. I didn't write it down or highlight it, but do you have a rough estimate on how many people are at the Battle of Ashdown? Like, how many men are we talking about?
Oh, gosh, I don't know.
You counted somewhere? Like, was it 10,000 or 5,000 that he had at one point at some battle?
That sounds like a realistic projection. Sounds about right.
Okay. Now you mentioned the shield wall.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about the shield wall. You expounded that in the book. What was that particular technique?
Yeah, the shield wall, I mean, this goes all the way back to, ancient Rome, the Greeks. You had a very similar sort of thing. The Anglo-Saxon appropriation of it is probably a little bit sloppier, but it's still the general idea is you line up together with your shields in front, but you essentially kind of weave your bodies together and you've got a front line, but then you can have up to 12 or even 15 men deep behind them with everybody kind of like a rugby scrum, weaving their bodies together. And then you advance with your shields like that. And then your spears can go through it. So you go and you hit you hit your enemy like that. And if you can hold your shield wall together, it's actually, it's actually safe would be the wrong word, but it's surprising how well it can hold together. And so as long as these guys hold together, the shield wall stands and you hold the battlefield. But it's really interesting when you read an Anglo-Saxon account of a battle, the way the authors will always describe, like, and the battle turned or things started to go bad for one side. The way they always describe that is they'll say, and the shield wall broke. It's that moment when you get a little rip in the shield wall and it's not immediately formed up again. A man falls dead and the man behind doesn't jump up quickly. Or one that you'll see in some battles is somebody standing in the front and the shield wall chickens out and turns and runs. There's the Battle of Maldon is this famous English poem where the shield wall is there and there's some men that chicken out and they turn and they run. But when they run, they grab the Lord, the master that is leading them, Birknoth. He's the Earl that has led them into battle. They grab his horse and they ride away on Birknoth's horse. And the men who are in the shield wall look and they see it's Birknoth's horse riding away ridden by a man. They assume it was Birknoth. And so they believe the Earl has fled. So there's no reason to stand in the shield wall anymore. So they turn. And when they do that, the shield wall rips apart and the Vikings pour through. Mm. And you're toast once the shield wall breaks. Mm-hmm. And so there's this like real kind of poetry about like you stand in the shield wall and you don't let anything take you out. Because as long as the shield wall stands, we stand.
And then things were quite different. Then you note this, I think toward the end of the book, that this wasn't the day when, say, your top commanders sent the young men into battle.
Yeah, yeah. When Alfred goes to battle, Alfred goes to battle. Men don't go to battle for a king who doesn't step out there with them. There's an expectation that you stand with your king, not instead of your king. Mm-hmm. There's one thing, the other thing about Anglo-Saxon society, and I think whenever I teach Anglo-Saxon lit, I always try to introduce the society as basically there's two kind of fundamental realities. There's the shield wall, which I just described. And then on the other side is the mead hall, which is this, it's this major, like it's like a huge dining lodge that the boys gather together in. And there's a raging fire. And everybody's sitting around. The king is not high on a throne. He's sitting on a bench with his men around him. And usually the king's wife is walking around with a huge ox horn that is gilded, with gold, but hollow. And it's filled with mead, wine made from honey. And she goes and she pours it for each of the men. And as she's pouring this mead for them, and the king is a ring giver. It's one of the most common names for a king is he's a ring giver. He gives rings, but he gives jewelry, but he also gives weapons, a sword, a suit of armor, or a shield, whatever. He's giving armor and swords. So men who are sitting at his table, they feast at his table. His wife pours the mead for him, and they receive all these gifts. But then the thing that is supposed to happen as he's giving these gifts is these men – are supposed to swear oaths, which is, and the oath is basically when you go to battle, when they come for you, I will be there with you. I promise to stand with you. And that's like the wise queen, as she's pouring the mead, she knows how to elicit these oaths out of the men. Like, he's giving you this. What are you going to do? And so there are all these oaths and vows that are made in the mead hall. But it's when you step in the shield wall, you find out who was good for their vow or who mm-hmm. wasn't. Beowulf ends with a bunch of men running away in fear. And the one man who stands, Wiglaf, you know, like he's chiding them like, you are worthless. Like, when our king gave you that sword that you're holding, don't you know what you were supposed to do with that sword? And you run away like a coward. So the whole thing, it's like you've got the mead hall and you've got the shield wall. And the thing that holds it all together is everybody's vows. If I swear this, then I got to be good for it. So the whole society works on vows.
Very nice. I want to jump back to Alfred's story in just a minute, picking up when he's coming out of the marshes and then what's going to happen next. But before we do, there's one other theme that kind of comes through, and he faced this at times. You have the Vikings, they're raiding. Maybe you can't move your men quick enough. Maybe you just know that this is going to be a bigger battle than I can fight. And you have this option of paying the Danegeld.
Yeah.
Should you ever pay the Danegeld? What is the Danegeld? Should you ever pay the Danegeld?
And the Danegeld. So the thing about the Vikings that I think is interesting and is really our modern Hollywood version of the Vikings gets very wrong. The Hollywoodized Viking is the Vikings are the scary warriors that the Christians couldn't face, that they'll destroy the Christians, which is just not true at all. The Christians had no problem squaring off against the Vikings. And in an open battle, the Christian Saxons did just fine against the Vikings and regularly just destroyed them.
Also, no horns on the helmets, right?
There's
no
that. Horns. There's that. I can't imagine going into hand-to-hand combat with these ridiculous antlers. This will scare them. The thing that made the Vikings so difficult was that they were deceitful liars and tricksters, which, you know, I just described, like, the Saxon world holds together on, like, you said you would do this, so you'll do this, right? I mean, you make a vow, you keep your vow. When Alfred starts his law code, I think the first thing he addresses is, like, when you make vows, you keep them. Everything holds together with this. The Vikings knew how to be tricky and deceitful. And if you read Viking literature from this time, they really emphasize the trickster. And the literature is a bit ridiculous sometimes because they just have a very different way of thinking. And I think the Saxons had a hard time understanding it. So the Vikings would come, they would say they would do one thing, and then they didn't do it. And the Vikings would attack. When they would attack a monastery. They wouldn't come and face you in open battle. They'd attack a monastery. And if you cornered them, they would build a circle of defenses and then they'd sit behind it and they'd say, we'll wait. Because the whole Saxon army were a bunch of farmers who had to get back home. They were only there for a week and the Vikings knew it. They would just say, we'll wait. The Vikings were really good at inflicting a lot of damage to the Saxons while dodging and not facing the Saxons in open battle. And it was very difficult for the Saxons to figure out how to deal with that. And the Vikings basically said, listen, tell you what, just pay us, you know, these 1,000 silver coins and we'll just go home and you don't have to worry about it. And the Saxons regularly was like, it was just too easy. Like it just felt like, okay, if I just pay them this, they'll go away. We can all go back to life as normal and it'll be good. And so that fee that was paid is called the Danegeld. Geld is just Saxon for money. And so the Danegeld was the Dane money. And so they would pay the Danegeld. The Danes would take the money. They'd leave for about a little bit. Then they'd turn around and come back. And next time they want twice the amount of money. And Kipling has a great poem about the Danegeld where he says, if once you pay the Danegeld, you'll never get rid of the Dane. If you give in to this, it's an easy moment to buy your peace, but it's a very temporary peace, and you just guaranteed it's going to be 10 times worse next year. And that's what happens. That's why the Saxons you know, they start in the north and they just take, or sorry, the Vikings, they start in the north and then they slowly work their way down through each of the Saxon nations because the Saxons can't figure out how to stand against the Vikings. They just can't figure it out. And that's what Alfred finally does is he digs in and he figures out how to stand against the Vikings.
One of those, one of the techniques he came up with was the Vikings were far too swift with their boats getting in and out. And then the Anglo-Saxons couldn't form their army.
Yeah, the feared.
Quick enough, right? Yeah. And so Alfred actually like restructured the towns, the burghs.
The burghs, yeah. So Alfred, it's interesting when you have somebody in whom so many things come together once because he's a logistical genius. He basically lays out England in a series of these, he calls them the burghs, which is a word for fortress. So you'll see this in Germanic languages and whatnot, where Strasbourg, Hamburg, and then you get the same thing, Scarborough. Borough is just another variation on that. So these are fortress towns in that he spaces at regular distances throughout England. And so he makes sure that each town is one day's ride away from the next. So one burg can respond to another, make sure they all have roads. He even the city itself, he sets up a layout for how to set your roads so that the city can be well defended. So even to this day, you can when you go to, for instance, when you go to Oxford, the roads are laid out as Alfred had them laid out. And you can see the mark of Alfred's, you know, fingerprint on all these English towns. So in America, we have your quintessential main street. In England, you have your quintessential high street. And high street is the street that splits the city in half. So if we're being attacked on one side and then the attack switches to the other, you can quickly bring your troops across town with perpendicular walls and then, perpendicular roads that you can get to anywhere you need very quickly. And then a wall street. So the idea of a wall street is the street that goes around the wall. And it allows troops to move inside the burg really swiftly to defend it. He even calculates how much acreage of land is necessary as farmland to support a certain number of people, and how many people do you need to defend a certain size of city wall. And then he coordinates the size of the city wall with the agricultural land outside, so that every city can feed and support the men that it needs to defend its walls. Mm. And he does these kinds of things throughout all of England. So he starts his own navy. And basically when the Vikings try to reinvade after he's driven them all the way out and he makes all of his reforms, the Vikings try to invade again and they get destroyed. They come with an army. It's like three times as big as what they'd had before, but they don't stand a chance because he's just put so much time to getting everything ready and they can't stand against him.
And he literally put the burghs. The burghs didn't exist. They were more spread out.
Some of them did exist, and some of them he starts all on his own. Some of them are old Roman towns that he rebuilds, and then some of them are towns that he begins straight from the beginning.
Mm, okay. All right. So let's pick back up. He's in these marshlands. He gets out. He faces Guthrum. Guthrum's infamous. So talk about Alfred and Guthrum, what happens in the battles, what happens. We got, of course, the baptism thing, which is quite fascinating. So just play that out for us.
Well, it's interesting because, first of all, you have to realize what's at stake. As the Vikings have worked their way through each of the Saxon kings that they've conquered, if you're a Saxon king and you're captured by the Vikings, they're going to have some fun with you. You're going to die. And they're going to enjoy putting you to death.
What about this eagle? Your book or the Blood Eagle?
The Blood Eagle.
Now, do you think that was a real thing or do you think it was made up afterward?
It's debated. It's debated, but I remember reading Alfred Smythe, who's probably, I think, the most well-researched, particularly on the Viking side of all the scholars I read. And he agreed it was a real thing. Oh, and some argued that this was just something that was a mythology that was invented to scare people. And some argued, no, it was real. Smythe argued it was real. And he's probably one of the top Viking scholars that I know. And it's a horrific and grotesque manner of execution. But you also have others. Is it Eyal who's shot full of arrows till they try to make him look like a porcupine with how many arrows they put into him? He's still alive, but they're having fun with him. So all of these Saxon kings are executed in gruesome ways. So for Alfred to stay is gutsy.
But before you go on, you got to tell us what the Blood Eagle is.
Oh yeah, so right.
What is? See,
I have to be careful because I actually have had people start to get like legitimately sick as I'm walking through. It is grotesque. They lay you on the ground face down, and then with axes chop holes in the rib cage around the spine, and then the idea is to reach in and grab the lungs and pull them up out through the hole that you have made. And the idea being that if you're still alive, they're still inflating a little bit and you've got little wings that flap on your back as you slowly die in excruciating pain. The Vikings were sick.
Sick.
I mean, it's kind
of, you don't want to lose to the, in that.
No, you don't.
You don't want the shield wall to break.
Exactly. And that's why actually you'll see at this time in Rome, there's a whole subdivision that is formed. It's called the Saxon Quarter. And it's because of all the Saxon kings that are like, I'm out of here. And they all abandon their kingdoms and they move to Rome and they just live in Rome. And that's it. It's like snowbirds, but they're not coming back. And so Rome has this really significant Saxon quarter. And it's all the kings that were getting out of there. For Alfred to stay was kind of exceptional.
Because didn't he go when he was young?
Yeah, he goes Rome. Once or twice. It depends on how you read it, but at least once, and probably he goes twice to Rome as a little kid. And I think that has a profound impact on him and the idea of building and all of that. Oh. But so Guthrum's coming, and like for Alfred to stand against Guthrum is pretty terrifying. But in the end, he wins. He's victorious, and they actually capture Guthrum. And the big question is so we've seen what the Vikings do to Saxon kings. So what should Alfred do to Guthrum? And it's the craziest thing. This is down in Athelney now, at the little village church in Athelney, and he takes Guthrum as his godson and baptizes him, which the font that Alfred baptized Guthrum in is still there in Athelney.
It's in Athelney, it's in the marshland
there's
area.
There's a little church there, and church is the church where it happened, and the font is still there. It's really cool to go see. So he baptizes them. There's some Saxon theory on godson. They took baptism very seriously. Like they took the idea that there is a rebirth very seriously. So you're reborn and you need a new family. And the Godfather is your actual new father. Like we are kin now. And so in the same way, the Saxons would do, they had this practice. They refer to it as the Frithelweba, peace weaver. Sorry, Frithelweba is the Saxon word, the peace weaver. If we were at war with one another, I give you my daughter, and your son marries my daughter. Now we are family, because they've married. Because in-laws are never complicated relationships. Anyhow, so you have that. So they basically took that same strategy and applied it to baptism. They said you are reborn. I am your father. We're family. Alfred took Guthrum as his son. It's like, you're my son. You're not going to be a Viking like that anymore. You're a Christian. And he threw him like a 1 month feast, poured out gifts on him, and then sent him back to his area, to his region, and said, now be a Christian king. It's the weirdest, I don't recommend that as strategy, but in Alfred's case, it worked. And Guthrum is changed, and they are at peace from then on.
Oh. Well, got one more question for you. And I guess before we wrap up, the guys at Canon here made sure that I'm supposed to add this, the audio of this is on Canon Plus.
Yes.
So you can get the audio on Canon Plus. You can get the book wherever books are sold. Search it on the internet.
Yeah.
It's gonna come up there. But the audio is at Canon Plus. They want you to know that. Here's the final question. We're obviously both in education. I'm the dean at NSA. You're the president of NSA. And you write about his educational reforms, just remarkable educational reforms. You mentioned he translated, you noted Soliloquies by Augustine. Uh-huh. You also noted Pastoral Care by Gregory the Great, which I thought was a fascinating text. Consolation of Philosophy, first 50 Psalms. He's translating them from Latin into Anglo-Saxon while fighting off Guthrum and avoiding the Blood Eagle.
Yeah.
He's doing all of that.
It's crazy.
So just maybe last question, we speak to his educational reforms now that he's pushed them back. You can read the book to get more details about how Alfred's life wraps up. But let's finish with this question about what did he do educationally? How is that related to like Christendom itself and defending against the Vikings?
Alfred believed that the reason the Vikings were able to take over England was because England was under God's judgment for having forsaken him. He said, we've become faithless, we've forsaken our God, and that's why all of this is happening. And so at the heart of everything for Alfred, it was all about first personal individual regeneration and renewal, and then the belief that this needed to be experienced by his whole nation. And so he believed deeply that the only reason the Vikings had done what they had done was because England had turned its back on God, and they needed to turn themselves back to God. So he wanted a spiritual revival throughout Anglo-Saxon England. And he believed the reason they had turned their back on God and the thing that they needed for their spiritual revival was they had forgotten their learning, and they needed to recover learning to take them to the texts that opened up the wisdom of God for them. He says in one of his prefaces, it's like Alfred was he was definitely a man's man. One of his favorite pastimes is hunting. He just loved hunting. And he's trying to explain to his men, like these men who had stood in the shield wall with him, but they don't know their alphabet, let alone how to read Latin. And he said, listen, what if you were like a guy who came across a set of deer prints in the hoof prints in the snow and or in the mud, and you saw it, but let's say you didn't have enough sense or understanding or skill to figure out how to track that deer. You're going to go hungry tonight, right? If you want to eat tonight, you need to learn what those signs mean so that you can get to this thing that you want. He said, that's the written word. God has this massive treasure, this wisdom that has been laid down for us. And you, because of your laziness, won't take the time to learn how to read these prints and get to the thing that he has for you. And so he tells his men, if you want your job, you have to learn to read. And then the few that are really good, he says, those of you that are really good, now you're going to come with me. We're going to learn Latin. And then those of us that learn Latin, what we'll do is we'll translate the books most needful for all men to know. We're going to translate them into Anglo-Saxon so that all of our men can experience and taste the wisdom that God has stored up for us. Mm. It's really interesting because Alfred translates the first 50 Psalms into Anglo-Saxon when the Reformation hits. And, this is after Wycliffe. It's illegal to translate the Bible into the vernacular. And the Reformers, when they uncover, wait a minute, the English king, Alfred, translated into the vernacular, and Alfred becomes this kind of symbol for the Protestant reformers that like this is what we want to be like. I mean, we have precedent for this.
Wow, nice. Well, Ben, thanks for talking to me today. It was a fascinating book.
Thanks for having me.
I'll tell you, for guys that are into like this is a very interesting theme. Has all sorts of cultural applications for us right now.
Absolutely.
Who are our people? Where do we come from? What are we about? What's it like to stand on the shield wall and not let it break? Mead Hall, Ring Giver, all those themes just come out in your book. So thanks again for joining me. And pick up a copy of The White Horse King, The Life of Alfred the Great. Thanks again.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to check out the audiobook for The White Horse King, along with more from Pastor Jared Longshore and Dr. Ben Merkel on Canon Plus.